the Business on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. You see it, we help you do it. AIB, for the life you're after.
Well, this week, the former UK Prime Minister Tony Blair was extolling the benefits of AI, artificial intelligence. He's pushing for AI to reduce public sector workforce costs. Our next guest believes AI has the potential to be great, but he has massive concerns about how it's working so far. Dr. James Muldoon is one of the authors of Feeding the Machine, the Hidden Human Labour Powering AI. James, AI is, it's a loose term from everything from training computers to processing large quantities of data, chatbots, ChatGPT. It's an industry that's expected to be worth $1 trillion by 2030. And it's mostly run by just a few multinational tech companies. I suppose that begs the question, is it concentrated in too few hands? I mean, if you take, for instance, the historic comparison in the 19th century with railroads, it was a new technology, needed lots of investment, and a few big businesses ended up owning large numbers of railroads in America or whatever. But in this instance, James, because of the huge startup costs, could we have one or two operators who own the modern day equivalent of all the railroads in the world?
I think AI is going to concentrate power in a smaller group of really large tech companies. And I think we really need to start talking not just about big tech as an idea, but about big AI, because I think there's going to be a real shift in power about how tech, how AI is influencing technology. Large tech companies like Microsoft and Meta are now teaming up with AI startups to create these new alliances to fight for a larger market share. Back when, you know, Mark Zuckerberg and Jeff Bezos started their companies, you didn't need that much money to start a tech company. You know, Zuckerberg famously writes the code for Facebook in his dorm room. Bezos, you know, slightly less famously, starts Amazon with a series of $50,000 investments from friends and family. But if you think about how much it costs to train foundation AI models today, Sam Altman has recently put that figure at more than $100 million. And right now, you know, mid-2024, we can expect that number to be closer to $1 billion. And, you know, even the research institute Epoch AI has estimated that by 2030, the amount could be over $100 billion. So who has this kind of money? It's legacy tech companies. It's the really biggest tech companies in the world that have this kind of money. And last year, two-thirds of the $27 billion that was raised by AI startups actually came from just three companies, from Microsoft, Google, and Amazon.
So that puts a handful of companies in a very powerful position. It is already lucrative and will become more so. What about for workers in the companies that are perhaps on the periphery of what's going on? Is it lucrative for them?
Well, it really depends on where these workers are in the supply chain. If you are talking about the kind of leading tech executives and AI engineers, yeah, this is a really lucrative business indeed. And for top AI talent, there's currently an enormous competition, people getting up to $1 million a year, you know, getting personal invitations from Mark Zuckerberg to join his company. There's an enormous competition. However, we need to realize that there are kind of two sides of the coin. There's a hidden world and a human cost, because not all workers are benefiting equally. And in addition to these, you know, very highly remunerated tech executives and AI engineers, there are also millions of workers doing much less skilled data annotation work. And I think it's really these workers that are standing to lose out in this AI revolution.
You give some examples in the book, James, of these kinds of workers. One, for example, is a woman called Mercy in Kenya. Can you tell us a bit about her?
Yeah, I can definitely. Let me just explain a tiny bit about what data annotation is, and then I can kind of flow into the Mercy example. Because I think we assume that when these AI programs are kind of in the mix, that a lot of the manual work kind of disappears. Everything can be automated. Everything can just flow very quickly. But in fact, the exact opposite is often the case. These AI systems that make life easier, they actually rely on millions of hours of human labor to manually annotate the data sets used for their training. The quality of this data really matters a lot. So this annotation has to be extremely accurate. And let me give you one example of like an autonomous vehicle, like a self-driving car. You know, these vehicles, when they get out on the roads, they have to be able to recognize the difference between different objects on the road, right? What's a tree? What's a child? What's a street sign? And the way they do this is they actually get trained on thousands of hours of footage. And these videos are manually annotated by people drawing boxes around these images and teaching a computer how to recognize the difference between them. And so if you take 1 hour of annotated video footage, that's actually the result of 800 human hours.
Inevitably, James, this kind of work ends up being done in low-paid economies, whether it's in the developing world or in Africa. And you give some examples of that.
Yeah. So, you know, autonomous vehicles are just one among many different applications of AI, right? So, this is an example of computer vision in terms of language and text processing. You also have people that need to annotate and give examples to chatbots of different types of answers and different responses that people are looking for. And in the book, we talk about one such example. You just, you know, mentioned Mercy, who is a character in one of our books. She's a Kenyan content moderator. And so her job as part of these AI pipelines is to moderate content on social media posts. Now, Mercy works 10 hours a day and is expected to check one post every 55 seconds. So it's just again and again, the worst of the worst, you know, abuse, suicide, sexual content. She's just moderating these over and over. And on one particular day that we heard about in one of our interviews, she was moderating a video of a fatal car crash. And as she looks closer at the video of the car crash, she actually recognizes one of the faces and realizes that the victim of the car crash is her grandfather. So Mercy learns about the death of her own grandfather through moderating a toxic social media post.
And is there help available for employees like her?
Very limited, because what we learned is that after she watches this video and begins contacting her family members and informing her family, you know, the working conditions at the outsourcing facility where she's doing this work are so bad that her supervisor actually asked her to finish the remaining 4 hours that are left on her shift. So you could imagine, you know, for these remaining 4 hours, what is she doing? She's moderating post after post of this video and pictures, different angles of this fatal car crash, which has happened, you know, on a major street in her city. And the rest of her shift is just moderating these toxic images. It's just absolutely horrific stuff.
But don't organizations like the World Bank espouse the view that this kind of digital work is the future? It's a way of lifting some populations out of poverty.
So it is one popular view that we can give people work rather than aid. It was the title of a book written by the late CEO of Sama, which is a data annotation company. So Leila Janna really championed this idea that you could export these jobs rather than aid out to various workers in the global south. And I think what we're seeing is really a repeat of the sweatshop debate of the 1990s, right? People like Anita and others we interviewed are working 10-hour shifts. They're getting paid less than $2 an hour. They're on extremely strict targets. All aspects of their work are monitored and surveilled. They are tracked for accuracy, for efficiency, for speed. And what's more, they're all kept on a program in which they're only given short-term 1 or 3 month contracts. Large tech companies have an obligation to make sure that work done in their supply chains is undertaken in a responsible and ethical manner. And what we're seeing right now is a race to the bottom in terms of wages and conditions, because these workers are incredibly disempowered and they're competing in a global market in which this kind of digital work can be sent anywhere around the world. And it's really up to both the tech companies themselves and national governments to set standards and set regulations to say that this work has to be done in an ethical way, that it shouldn't be an exploitative industry that is simply taking advantage of vulnerable workers.
Have you any confidence in the ability of regulation, political policy, whether it's workers themselves rejecting all of this. Have you confidence that we can come up with a fairer system through this?
Well, we think the most important thing is for workers to organise collectively and for us as consumers and civil rights groups to support those workers in organising. We think there's a very clear role for increased legislation here, for protecting fundamental rights, the rule of law, environmental sustainability, and ensuring that these AI companies don't just have a carte blanche to do whatever they want in this space.
Well, it's a fascinating read. Many thanks, Dr. James Muldoon. And Feeding the Machine, the Hidden Human Labour Powering AI, is published by Canongate Books.